106.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It was 1967 when a now famous line was first heard in a movie starring Dustin Hoffman. That line, as odd as it may have sounded at the time, was actually prescient.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
Exactly. How do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. Will you think about it?
Yes, I will.
I've said, that's a deal.
That line in the film The Graduate caught America's attention for many reasons, not the least of which was that in 1967, the invasion of plastic was just beginning. Today, plastic is everywhere and seemingly in everything. It's becoming a big problem because not only can it be found in the products we buy and the bags and cartons we carry those products home in, but in our landfills, our waterways, and in our oceans. There are great garbage patches in the Pacific, and much of the debris in those patches of garbage are tiny pieces of plastic. Today we talk about how we're disposing of plastic, at the problem plastic is creating around the globe, and what we can do to change all of that. One of our guests today has found a unique way to make a small contribution toward change. Aurora Robson is an environmental artist in residence at the McCall Center for Visual Art. Her Stayin' Alive exhibit there will be on view beginning today through July 26th and demonstrates her philosophy of creating art through intercepting the waste stream. Much of that stream contains plastic, and much of her art reuses that plastic. And we've put much of her art, well, not much, but some of her art, up on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalk so that you can see what we're talking about as we talk about it. Welcome to the program, and welcome to Charlotte.
Thank you so much, Mike.
You're very nice to have you with us. Also with us in our Spirit Square studios, Dr. Mike Lazat, who is the Sustainability Officer for UNC Charlotte. We'll talk about exactly what that is in a second. But you, too, have a kind of a plastic art exhibit going on as well, don't you?
Right. At our Center City building, we have a couple of exhibitions that have been going on all spring, and there'll be a film called Bag It coming up next Friday.
Plastic is the new acrylic. And acrylic kind of is a plastic, isn't it? Nancy Wallace is also with us. She is the Marine Debris Program Director for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She is with us by phone from Silver Spring, Maryland. Good morning and welcome to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
And the President and CEO of the McCall Center for Visual Art is here. Suzanne Fetcher is going to be involved in part of this program as it involves art, and particularly Aurora's display of art, which opens today at the McCall Center. Thank you for being here as well. Good morning.
Thank you.
UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute started a project called Keeping Watch Initiative. You, too, have enlisted artists who work with plastic and with, I guess, junk. I know that we talked to one of the artists from South America who came in here and did an installation going around the city of Charlotte and just picking up debris on the side of the street, going to landfills. And one of the things that I remember that he said was that our trash is very different from South American trash and that our plywood isn't as good. I remember that. You're also screening a movie tonight at 6 called Bag It, Is Your Life Too Plastic? Why all this sudden attention on plastic?
Well, I think part of it is kind of a recognition that, as you said, it's common throughout society now. And on the side of the people who are responsible for sort of maintaining our trash, finding safe places to put it, recycling it, it's pretty widely recognized that's the material we're missing, you know, that we're letting go through to the landfills. You know, it's safe in a way if it makes it into a landfill because it doesn't break down very much. It's not going to get into the water system so easily. But on the other hand, it's a material that could be used. And reused many times over, and in North America, we don't do a good job of closing that loop.
Well, I remember the days when shampoo came in glass bottles, and you'd often drop them in the shower, and that was never very good. Never very good. The same thing with milk bottles. The milkman would deliver them to the front door, and they'd be in these big, heavy glass bottles, and you could drop those all over the kitchen floor, too. Then along came these plastic bottles, and it was like a godsend. Plastic is this miracle product because it can be folded, it can be molded, it can be rigid, it can be colorful, it can be transparent, it can be strong and structural, it can be made to be completely, absolutely, quickly disposable. In many cases, it's meant to be disposable within seconds of your obtaining it. And that's why it's all around us. And that's why it's a problem, correct?
Right. I mean, in addition to that list, one that's fairly easy to relate to is the weight, too. We save a lot of money shipping things now because the plastics get lighter and lighter. One thing the audience may recognize is that if you use bottled water, how thin the bottles are getting. They're almost like bags now. You mm-hmm. can squeeze them. And that's because the engineers are finding ways to use – I mean, this is a good thing. They're finding ways to use less plastic to get the job done. But that's a big advantage, and one of the reasons why plastics are taking over the role of glass, or in some cases they're beating out aluminum for a storage.
Which is worse, aluminum cans or plastic bottles? On the environment, I mean. Which is worse?
I have to say that's like the paper plastic question at the supermarket. Right?
Which is worse, paper or plastic?
It's tough.
Trees or oil? Trees temporarily or oil forever?
Yeah, so my background is as a scientist, so I'm going to sound like I'm waffling here. But they both have pros and cons, and you can make an argument. And probably the best thing to do is to say, where are you? You know, if you're in a place where paper is readily available, and you have a good recycling system, which could be your culture, your society. If they're actually recycling the paper will be better. If you lived in a society that could handle plastics and recycled them very well, that might end up being the best thing in your society.
We're going to talk about these vast patches of garbage in the ocean, Nancy Wallace. But I'm curious, in those vast patches of ocean garbage, is plastic the major problem, or are cans a problem, aluminum cans, or other pieces of material that we use on land that find its way to sea? What's the biggest part of the problem there?
Well, we certainly see every type of product in the ocean environment, and especially during shoreline cleanups, you see every type of consumer product, whether it be aluminum cans, plastic bottles, plastic bags, cigarette butts, food wrappers, all of the things that we use on a daily basis can end up in the ocean environment. The thing about plastics is they're made very well. They're made to be durable. They're made to last, which is good when we're using them on land. The challenge is when they end up in the marine environment, they don't break down well, or they break down into smaller pieces, but they never fully degrade. So when we're talking about these, garbage patches, which are really not a mass of garbage as we might think of, but sort of spread out throughout the ocean currents, most of it really is the plastic material, and that may be because it also floats more. A heavier aluminum can may sink to the bottom, and we don't have as much data about what's on the bottom floor.
Will aluminum degrade in a saline environment, or will it just sit there forever on the bottom of the ocean?
Yeah, I mean, I think of it like any other material over time. It will degrade, but it will never fully degrade back to the element. So there's always going to be pieces of it. What we have found, too, is that a lot of people really know to recycle aluminum cans. Some places there's actually deposits that you get back. So in terms of what we're finding on the beaches or in the nearshore area, it tends to be more of the plastic products.
I think about 100 million pounds of plastic, or tons, 100 million tons of plastic is produced every year, 10% of which, I'm told, ends up in the oceans. That's 10 million tons a year of plastic. Is that why you became interested in working with plastic, Aurora, in an art form?
Well, actually, initially, I was intrigued by the formal qualities of plastic waste.
What are the formal qualities of plastic?
From a sculptural standpoint, this material is designed to last anywhere from 100 to 1,000 years when it's left in the environment, which makes no sense for it as a, quote-unquote disposable object. Mm-hmm. So what I liked were the complex compound curves, the way it light passes through it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these bottles, in particular the PET plastic, have a great deal of structural integrity. You can do all kinds of things with them.
You can work with it.
Yeah, and I really like that, you know, most people encounter this material every day. So it's very accessible,
mm-hmm.
and it's very intimate. Mm-hmm. Like, we put this to our mouths and trust it implicitly. But we don't really know the chemical composition. Most people have no idea what it's made out of.
Right. And we stick things in microwave ovens that we do know that when you heat them up, they could produce things that are not very healthy with us. And it gets into the food in the trays, in the ovens, and yet we still do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, certain, you know, toxic plasticizers have been added to this material for, you know, ever since it was made.
Right.
And, you know, it's only a few years ago that it was made illegal in baby bottles.
Mm. Does anyone know how much plastic actually ends up in landfills or actually goes to recycling centers to be recycled every year, as opposed to just slipping through the stream and into the oceans? Anybody know?
Well, the EPA says less than 10% of all plastics
is recycled. Less than 10%? Is that because we're lazy, or is it because that's all they can accommodate at the recycling center?
It's a really complex issue. So I'm not sure. I'm not a 100%, you know, authorized to say, but I, you know, this is a figure that's pretty staggering to think of by itself.
Now, we've heard, now of course, most plastics are made of petrochemicals, but there are plastics that are made of other things, other elements that make them more biodegradable. And so when we buy these plastics, we feel good about it because, oh, it's gonna degrade over time. Maybe 10 years, 15 years, it'll be gone. But what you're telling me, Nancy and Dr. Lizotte, is that it really never goes away. There's no such thing as plastic going away, correct?
That is correct. So the biodegradable plastics that you may find, some of them can only sort of biodegrade in certain compostable ways or in certain conditions, and they never really fully biodegrade. Sometimes it's the links between the polymers of plastics that have, you know, maybe a more natural source that can degrade, but the actual polymers themselves are not breaking down, and especially in the marine environment where you have different conditions, we are not seeing these materials breaking down.
Now, I have stored things in the attic in plastic bags, thinking that, well, I'll just keep it in this plastic bag, and then I've gone up several years later after many cycles of extreme heat and extreme cold and lifted the bag up only to have the bag completely disintegrate at my feet into little tiny pieces. I guess that means it's biodegradable, correct?
Well, it's probably not biodegrading back to its original elements. And so the challenge with plastics, especially in the marine environment, is that they do break up. So they certainly get smaller and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge there is that when they're smaller and smaller, they can be consumed more easily by fish or by birds. So it doesn't mean that they're going away. It can just mean that they're changing their size and shape.
And the go ahead, Mike.
Another thing that plastics do is it's not biodegrading, which means a microbe or an organism's helping break it down. A lot of plastics can't handle full sunlight, so just the UV radiation will bust them up.
Mm-hmm.
And so if anybody's ever used the wrong plastic outside to cover their garden or something, they come out and they find it's just this shredded thing and 'cause you didn't buy the right plastic. So there's a lot of there is some physics and chemistry to break them down. But I think, you know, part of this, we are talking about which is good, we're talking about the plastics we have today, but it's probably worth mentioning that there are a lot of chemists and the top chemical companies are working on this issue of whether it could be a true biodegradable plastic. So they're, for example, worked with a couple of companies that are making out of corn, they're making a product with bacteria, and bacteria can completely break it down.
Yes, I want to talk about that in a second because that sounds relatively disturbing to me, but we'll get into that, and we'll get into the artwork that is being produced by using plastic by Aurora Robson in a second or two. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, nonprofit blood supplier to 22 of the region's hospitals. Only donors can meet the area's constant need for blood. CBCC.us. And Tupelo Honey Cafe celebrating Mother's Day all week, featuring bellinis and appetizers as well as breakfast, lunch, and dinner. 1820 South Boulevard. Details at TupeloHoneyCafe.com. health.com. North Carolina's Medicaid program serves about 1.8 million people, but several audits have found that it's wasting a lot of taxpayer money. Governor McCrory had rolled out a plan that would have probably put a few insurance companies in charge, but now he's pushing for an overhaul that would give doctors and hospitals a larger role in managing care and reining in costs. Guest host Michael Tomsic will join you on Monday to take a look at that problem at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. A White House report on climate change urges immediate action. The nominee to head Health and Human Services faces her first day of confirmation hearings. And Monica Lewinsky speaks out.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about plastic in the environment and plastic in the world of art. It sounds strange, but it really isn't. Aurora Robson is with us. She's an environmental artist in residence at the McCall Center for Visual Art, along with Suzanne Fetcher, who's the president and CEO of that organization. And her exhibit, Aurora's exhibit, called Stayin' Alive, opens today at the McCall Center and runs through the 26th of July. We have examples of her art, which we'll be talking about extensively in a few minutes here, on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks. Also joining us by phone from Silver Spring is Nancy Wallace, Marine Debris Program Director for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and Dr. Mike Lazotte is in our studio sustainability officer for UNC Charlotte and a scientist who has worked with plastics. And you were talking about scientists in chemical companies working to develop more fully biodegradable plastics through the use of bacteria. I read that yesterday and found that just a touch disturbing, because if bacteria is in the plastic, how are we using that plastic? it's not going to be in these water bottles, is it?
probably not, actually. I mean, so that's one of the things that they're concerned. I mean, right now the product we were testing were trash bags. So which could be a really handy thing if you're collecting like food waste to be able to put it into a bag where the whole bag can go into, as Nancy mentioned, into these special places like composters or digesters. So it's a product we need, and it won't touch our mouths and we won't be eating out of it. But I have to say, going to conferences, some of the properties of that plastic, its softness and such, were things that they were talking about other problematic plastic things in the world, like that are just hard to make, like a straw or the top of your coffee cup, and making something that can go into the, you know, be digested so that somebody can take a coffee cup, most of which is paper and compostable, but since it's got these plastic pieces stuck on it, it becomes a problem for us to put it in the right bin.
And it seems to me that the other problem with plastic, and maybe this is a problem that is particular to Charlotte, is that some of it is recyclable and some of it is not. And try as I might, I cannot keep it in my head. I don't know what is and what isn't, so I just throw it all in the recycling bin. Let them deal with it, which I know is a bad thing, but I can't remember it. Why isn't all plastic available to go to the recycling bin?
Well, I think part of it is would be narrowing the number of choices so that and that would be much more consumer friendly. I actually agree with you. I think you're doing the right thing. You know, give it to the people who have the ability to sort it out and let them deal with it. Mm-hmm. And actually a lot of communities are going to that so-called single stream, which can handle a lot of materials and basically it's a factory setting where things get sorted out. I would think even, you know, Nancy would sort of agree that that's a, you know, if we know it's going into a stream we can control, the worst thing is it's getting sorted out and sent to a landfill, but it's not ending up on the sidewalk or in a stream or in the ocean.
Well, that's part of the problem. Some of this plastic ends up in streams and creeks. It goes into the rivers. It goes into the bays. And then it ends up in the ocean. And then it ends up in these great big garbage patches in the ocean. If there was a better recycling system around the world, Nancy, would the problem with the oceans decrease?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the major things that we're working on, and certainly working with the plastics industry on that, because I think if we could recover this material in a responsible way and reuse it, we would really be limiting the amount that's ending up in those streams and in the oceans. But it's, you know, it's also about using less. I think we need to think about the products we're using and try to make good decisions about how much we need to use them. And then if we do decide to use single-use items, then we need to recycle them. And if we can't, then we do need to dispose of them in a landfill and properly. But, you know, it's kind of all of those different options will help to not make it into the water.
Which is worse for marine life in the oceans? Is it the tiny, almost microscopic, and sometimes actually microscopic pieces of plastic that have degraded to the size of something you can't see without a microscope? Is that the bigger problem, or is the bigger problem floating debris like old detergent bottles or the little wrappers that hold our six packs of soda together? Which is the worst problem?
Well, I think it depends on what kind of animal you are. You know, if you are a humpback whale and you get entangled in these fishing nets that are out there, which is also marine debris, that can be pretty right. detrimental. Or a packing band around a sea lion, you know, that can be very damaging. The challenge with some of these smaller plastics is, unfortunately, there's a lot of legacy pollutants in the oceans, you know, just from different chemicals that have been done over the years. These plastics can act as a vector for those pollutants because of the properties, and then those can be ingested by fish or by crabs or, you know, oysters. And we don't really know what the impacts are now. That's a lot of the science we're doing, is trying to see what the impacts from those small plastics where the chemicals are leaching onto them and what impacts they may be having to the animals. So there's a lot of different impacts depending on the type of debris and the type of marine life you are.
I know that years ago, people on board ships used to just throw the garbage overboard and let it float away. That is not really the case to a great degree anymore, and I understand that most of the debris that we have in the oceans, particularly in these great pools of debris, are actually from the land. They are not from people at sea. They somehow make their way into streams and creeks and rivers and then out into the ocean. How does that happen? I mean, I don't recall ever throwing a bottle in a creek. So how does that happen?
Well, that's a really good question. I think a lot of it happens not on purpose. You know, I think I live in Washington, D.C., and I know a lot of people recycle and throw their trash out, you know, in the garbage cans on the street. Unfortunately, some of those get tipped over, and you see the trash on the street, even the recyclables. Some people maybe do litter. A lot of people flick their cigarette butts out the car window. That's a form of littering. They don't degrade. They can end up in the streams and carried out to the ocean, too. So a lot of it's just about raising awareness about the products we use and how we dispose of them properly. And some of it's not purposeful, but accidents happen, and things can, you know, overflow, especially during high storms, lots of water running off, you know, storm drains can overflow. All of that kind of flows downhill. And if you have a stream in your backyard, it can lead into a bigger river, which can then lead into the ocean. And then those products are there for a very long time.
And it's also, therefore, a freshwater problem. And I know that your organization at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration also deals with the Great Lakes. How big a problem is this in the Great Lakes?
It's a big problem in the Great Lakes, too. I mean, yes, we tend to think about the ocean environment, but the Great Lakes certainly are impacted as well. In fact, we, with NOAA, have been, for the past 2 to 3 years, embarking on a Great Lakes Marine Debris Action Plan, which doesn't make a lot of sense with the word marine there, but it's a freshwater debris action plan because the runoff from cities are ending up in the Great Lakes, too. So we're certainly concerned about that. And in fact, states like Illinois have started to introduce legislation about banning microbeads from cosmetic products. Because a lot of people don't know that there's actually plastic in cosmetics or toothpaste, and that can run right into the water as well, so the Great Lakes or the ocean.
There's plastic in toothpaste?
There are, you know, all these very teeny tiny pieces of plastic in some toothpaste and in some exfoliants for your skin. It's
what
a way to
let's name some names. what toothpaste has plastic in it?
I would know off the top of my head. I think that's something we would want to talk to the industry about. But yeah, I mean, it's about getting your teeth whiter, and the plastics have an abrasive quality. So, you know, it's becoming more people are becoming aware of that now and becoming concerned about that. And so I think the awareness is a good thing because then people can make decisions.
So Dr. Lazat, do you know names? Do you have names of brands of toothpaste with plastic in them? Do you have access to that information?
I'm actually not sure you could even tell from labels because sometimes these would be called inert ingredients.
Yes.
and so if the...
Is silica plastic?
No,
it's sand, isn't it?
That would be more of a natural sand, yeah.
Okay.
But they may be making a replacement, you know, yeah, like that, and it may not be anything they have to list as an ingredient.
And that's part of the problem, then, isn't it?
I think for consumers it is. Nancy was mentioning raising awareness, and so how does the consumer know what they're using? You confessed earlier about the difficulty of knowing whether the plastics in your life are recyclable or not. Our art exhibit, the sort of big dramatic piece that's in the Center City building right now, is a giant baby that is filled with toys, plastic toys. And the artist, Joyce Dalal, when she was here explaining it to us on the opening, mentioned that she got involved with it simply because she had a child who was outgrown their toys, and she tried to recycle them and find a home for them. And she was told that no one wanted them, and they weren't good donations. And she was even told by one person in her community that these were toxic waste. And so she just stored them for a while until she had the right art concept, mm-hmm, in which to try and share it with the public and raise awareness.
I want to come back to these big patches of garbage in the Pacific in a second or two, but you lead us very well into the artistic part of the plastic program that we're doing today. Aurora Robson is here, and she's an environmental artist in residence at the McCall Center for Visual Art. Her exhibit called Stayin' Alive opens today and runs through July. Now, why the name Stayin' Alive?
Well, a few different reasons. I'm trying to take kind of a somewhat dark topic. I'm really, you know, the whole idea of recycling plastic isn't even that accurate. The vast majority of this material is getting downcycled. And most people don't...
That means what?
Well, most people think if they put this in the recycling bin, this plastic water bottle, it'll come back as the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That typically does not happen. You know, it comes back as a lesser plastic. So we have to create new virgin material all the time. So, you know, I'm thinking a lot about, you know, this kind of... You know, it's a bigger problem than people realize.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, what Nancy was saying earlier about microplastics and, you know, this plastic we implicitly trusted in all of these products that we put in our body and on our body and in our babies' bodies. And, you know, bisphenol A, for example, is like a additive to many plastics. And, you know, there's questions about whether it's a carcinogen or an obesogen or causes an endocrine disruptor, all these other health-associated risks. So to me, it's a really dark topic. So I thought Stayin' Alive, you know, speaks to this idea of what it means to stay alive on Earth, and do we want to dedicate ourselves to making sure that's a reality?
How long have you been working in this medium? If plastic is a medium, how long have you been working in it?
I hope it's a medium. I think it should be. I mean, it has archival integrity.
Yes, it does, because it lasts forever.
Exactly.
I mean, your work will be around long after the Mona Lisa has just faded into the canvas.
Well, yeah, there's that. Hopefully it'll find an appropriate home. But, you know, I think that it's a really interesting and relatively unexplored material. And it has all these different properties. Like you were saying, it comes in all different colors and shapes and types of, you know, thickness and durability and flexibility. So it's really wonderful. It lends itself to sculpture. And I think, you know, for me, I like to look at art as a experimental process where you're constantly striving to achieve new things and make things that are not visible, visible through material. Like, that's the artist's job.
So what you're saying is that these plastic, we don't even see these plastic bottles. They're so much a part of our everyday life. They're mm-hmm. They are invisible to us, that we just use them and get rid of them. You're bringing this to our attention by using them in an artistic way so that we can see what? Not only that we use tons of this material every day, but that it's all around us in everything we own.
Pretty much. And also, maybe, you know, I like to think it'll encourage people to try to reduce their plastic footprints. you know.
Mm-hmm. You're actually considering this as intercepting the waste stream is the phrase that you use. It's not recycling. You're going in and taking things that would have gone to the recycler or would have made it to the landfills or into the ocean and making them works of art.
Exactly. I like the idea of taking the typical model for art making and reversing it. So usually people who are, you know, practicing some sort of creative art will go and buy some resources. And
like paints or
like
canvas.
And a lot of the time it involves chemicals that mm-hmm. are mined from the earth or resources that are mined from the earth, and then make a piece of art that may or may not end up finding its way into a home or a museum. So I like the idea of reversing that and saying, you know what, instead of taking anything like resources, start with the waste and end with the art, because it's much more challenging and interesting to me.
Suzanne Fetcher is here. She's the president and CEO of McCall Center for Visual Art. How do other artists see this philosophy, or do you know? And how groundbreaking is this philosophy? How unusual is this philosophy?
I think it's very unusual. I think that there are purists who think that you still have to use oil paint or marble or something like that as your material for the art form. But I think more and more artists are understanding that there are just so many possibilities, so many ways to make art that is really impactful and expressive and has really great meaning content. And so the experimental nature of what Aurora does, and she does it with such beauty and such integrity, I mean, the quality of what she's doing, you will never, when you look at it, really understand initially that it's plastic bottles. It's so sculptural and so beautiful. You know, it's breathtaking.
Some of it reminds me of the glasswork of Dale Chihuly.
Yeah.
And others of it is completely hers. I mean, it's just, you're right. It's ethereal. It's gossamer-like mm-hmm. in some ways. It is sturdy. It's all these different things, and light passes through it, and it's colorful. We have some pieces of her art up on our website so people can understand what it is we're talking about, because it's hard to describe it with words. How do these things pop into your head?
Well, it's actually surprising to most people that all of my work is really based on nightmares I had when I was a kid.
That's what I read.
So,
you had a very strange childhood.
Yeah, I did. It's true. But now I'm grateful for it, so it's all good. But, you know, the idea was, initially, I wasn't making work out of waste material. Mm-hmm. I was just sort of doing this quiet personal meditation on trying to take this nightmare landscape from my childhood and transform that into an inviting space.
Mm-hmm.
And something happened when I started working with debris that really changed the nature of my practice. And instead of it being a really personal, private meditation, it became much more open and more about creating something that's relevant to more people, you know, because this is a global health issue and art is a global language, so it felt very appropriate to me.
And I read that many of these do come from nightmares that you had as a child, and you're trying to make in three dimensions these nightmares come alive. I guess it's a cathartic experience for you, because they don't look like nightmares. They just look like things. I don't know how to describe them, what they look like. You'll have to go to the website or go to the exhibit to see it for yourself. But you said that you are using this as a way to communicate about a global nightmare, which is this plastic problem, correct?
That's right.
We have to take a break, come back and talk more about Aurora's artwork and more about this plastic problem. I want to get into these garbage patches in the ocean and why they seem to be confined to the Pacific, among other places. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Suzanne Vega, a lyrical talent and clear voice, performs with a hushed melodic sensibility Sunday, 7 p.m. in Booth Playhouse. Tickets at BlumenthalArts.org. And Donald Hack Diamonds, serving Charlotte for over 30 years with fine diamonds, engagement rings, custom design, and jewelry for all occasions. Donald Hack Diamonds, Sharon Road, across from South Park Mall, and DonaldHack.com. It's Friday. That means it's the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show, the National Hour. First, a group of journalists joins Diane to talk about the White House releasing a report on climate change and a message from President Obama that this is not some distant problem of the future. Sylvia Matthews-Burwell, the nominee to head the Department of Health and Human Services, faces her first day of confirmation hearings, and the House votes along partisan lines to form a panel to investigate the attacks in Benghazi in 2012. Just a few of the topics that they will be discussing coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show.
Fewer kids are going to jail when they get in trouble. They're getting GPS ankle monitors.
Sometimes I do get frustrated. I feel like I'm trapped in my own house. And just last night, I felt like the walls were closing in on me.
I'm David Gura. What tracking kids costs, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Aurora Robson, environmental artist in residence at the McCall Center for Visual Art. Her Staying Alive exhibit, which is all works of plastic, not all works of plastic. Correct me when I'm wrong. Just jump in there and tell me what it is.
Intercepting the waste stream.
Intercepting the waste stream. So it's not just plastic, but it is...
I use paper packaging. Okay. I use other types of materials.
And you just handed me a postcard that is all plastic that came from the ocean. It's a great work that you've produced out of this, but the fact that it all came from the ocean is frightening. Some of these are pretty big pieces of plastic.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. I actually made that piece a few years ago in Hawaii, and this wonderful Waimea Ocean Film Festival organization invited me out there, mm-hmm, to make a piece from plastic that washes ashore on the southern point of the Big Island. Mm-hmm. And a group called the Hawaii Wildlife Fund has been doing coastal cleanups there for about a decade now. Mm-hmm. And the first time they did a cleanup, they got 40 tons of plastic. Mm-hmm. It's a really remote stretch of beach, and they go back every 2 months and get, you know, around 2 tons every time. And it's from all over the world, washing ashore in Hawaii, which we think of as...
pristine,
yeah,
and beautiful, yeah. Dr. Michael Azad is also with us. He's a sustainability officer and a scientist at UNC Charlotte, who does a lot of work with other scientists on plastic. And Nancy Wallace joins us from Silver Spring, Maryland, where she is the Marine Debris Program Director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, also with us, Suzanne Fletcher of the McCall Center for Visual Art. I was very quickly corrected in the break by Aurora, Nancy, about how it's not just the Pacific Ocean that has these vast garbage, what did I call them? Garbage patches. They're in every ocean. Is that correct?
Yeah, Aurora is correct. Yes, and what it really is that within all oceans there are convergent zones. So there's areas where the currents come together, and I like to think of it as sort of an eye of a hurricane. You know, kind of that swirling motion where things come together, and so whatever is in the ocean is going to end up there, and that's kind of why we have these patches that people talk about. And I think there's a little bit of a myth that there's sort of these islands of garbage, and that's not true. But what's out there is converging in these gyres. And when that happens, there's certainly, it's like a, I like to think of it as like a peppery soup. You know, there's little pieces or big pieces kind of spread out in the ocean. But they do, they are, you know, certainly in the Pacific, there's a lot of evidence of them in the Atlantic and throughout the world's oceans.
So why don't we go out there with multiple ships and skim it? Just take it out.
Excellent, excellent question, and probably the question I'm asked most in this job. The challenge is that a lot of these pieces are very tiny, as we've been talking about. There are certainly big, you know, clumps of nets and things too, but the oceans are so big. You know, I think people lose perspective of just how vast the oceans are. And we don't exactly always know where these patches are because they move with currents up and down. Mm. And we'd really have to think about the environmental impact of sending multiple ships with fuel out searching for these pieces of plastic. And then also, if you start skimming up the ocean, you have to think about what else you're getting, you know, the little critters or the phytoplankton that belong there. What I try to focus on is cleanup is a great idea, and maybe in the future we'll have that technology to do it. But unless we stop stop the plastics and all the other debris from entering the marine environment, we're never going to be able to clean it all up. We have to stop it at its source.
Bruce emails, leatherback turtles, the huge ones, live on a diet of jellyfish and often mistake plastic bags for jellyfish. A beautiful 900-pound leatherback washed up on shore at Kiowa Island this week. She was full of plastic.
That's unfortunate, and that's what's happening. Plastic bags certainly are in the oceans, and yes, they turtles eat jellyfish. Plastic bags look like jellyfish, and we are finding that. We have a lot of necropsies from turtles that show plastic bags in their stomachs.
Dr. Lizotte.
Part of the art exhibit that's on display at the Center City building is...
At UNC Charlotte.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is Chris Jordan's Midway series, which is a set of photographs. They're actually, I think, stills out of a longer film where he went to Midway Island, a very far end of the Hawaiian chain, actually, a very remote part of the world, which is mostly inhabited by birds. And he just took pictures of very sort of lightly dissected birds that are littering the islands now. And when you open them up, they are basically a bag of plastic parts. Mm. So the birds have consumed enough of the floating plastic that their digestive system is completely filled with plastic, which means
they die.
If they do eat anything, they can't really digest it, and they right. eventually die.
So they're suffocating, basically.
Beth emails, Lego was listed in Discovery Place's exhibit of the 101 inventions that changed the world. That's true. It seems odd, but it makes sense. Before Lego discovered that they could use plastic to make their toys, they were made of wood, as were all children's toys. The plastic Legos exploded in popularity, and all the other toy manufacturers followed suit. If Lego hadn't gone plastic, we might not have Barbie or countless other toys. Vernon emails, Aurora, how many people really seem to get the bigger picture when they see your plastic art? That's a great question.
Well, that's a really hard question to ask. To answer, because they don't all tell me.
Well, for the people who buy your art, is part of the appeal what it's made of and where it came from and your zeal in pulling this stuff out of the waste stream and using it for more productive purposes. Is that part of the appeal?
I should hope so, but it's not necessary to me. You know, that's not... if they don't get it, it's sort of... To me, making the work I make is sort of like... I'm trying to write a book almost where you have this experience when you read it the first time, and it's your own voice talking to you mm-hmm. through the author's words. And then if you read it again 5 years later, you'll have a completely different experience. So maybe someone will purchase a piece and not really care or think that the plastic pollution issue is that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. But later on in life, they might become more educated about it, and it suddenly takes on a whole new meaning for them. So I'm not really interested in, you know, hammering into people's heads, but I do want to point out that I think it's only something like 30% of commercially produced plastics float. So what we're seeing in these patches in our oceans really only represents a small amount.
Just the stuff we can see. Much of it is further down in the current, in the stream, in the water column.
It sinks. Around 70% sinks of what is commercially produced. So that's kind of, you know, a big picture concern.
Just so people get an idea of who Aurora Robson is, your work has been exhibited internationally, and it's been featured in magazines. You've done a TED Talk. You've done a film for TED and I think the Lincoln Motor Company explaining about plastics. I'm not sure why Lincoln Motor Company is, since all cars are plastic now, it's, I don't know why they're so interested in helping with that. But as you go around the world, are people equally concerned about plastic? Do there seem to be parts of the world that are more concerned about it, parts of the world that are better stewards of keeping the plastic out of the environment than others?
Well, so far, I really love Charlotte. I mean, I've had a great time here.
You just said the right thing. Right?
part of what I've been doing here is trying to, you know, encourage education around this issue mm-hmm. and, you know, work with young people and have them you know, embrace this as a new way of working and conduct river cleanups and use that material to create art with. So,
how would you characterize the problem, Nancy? I mean, because you deal with this primarily in waterways and particularly in the ocean, but how big a problem? How where on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being a catastrophe, where is it?
Well, I think it's hard to give it a number. You know, for me, I work on this issue every single day, so I see the impacts every day. I think to a lot of people who might just, you know, not really be aware of the issue, you know, it's not something you think about. But, you know, for us, our oceans are really important. They are such a place where we get so much nutrition, and it's a place where if we don't take care of them, we are going to be in trouble. And the fact that there is so much trash, so much debris in the ocean, it really does have an impact. There are a lot of environmental problems, so it's hard to rank them all. But what I can say is that this problem, marine debris, is a very man-made problem. That is what debris is. It's man-made objects that are in the ocean that shouldn't be there.
And is this a particularly 20th, 21st century problem? Obviously, we've been throwing things into the ocean, and things have been going floating downstream into the ocean for since the beginning of time.
Right.
But those older things were made of wood, and I guess they just...
They would degrade.
Disintegrate.
Yeah. And so now, you know, but the good thing about this problem is that we can solve it. Because we're causing it, we can also solve it. So I think there's a lot of environmental problems that are just so complex, and we don't really know how to address them. But this marine debris issue is something we can really have an impact on.
Yeah, and that's one of the jobs of your agency, because you cannot make regulations that tell people to stop doing this or don't do that. You can only talk about, prevention, I guess.
Yeah, we do. We really try to go through partnerships and collaboration. So we provide a lot of funding to different communities to do removal of debris, some in North Carolina that we're working with right now to remove crab traps out in the ocean. And then we do a lot of prevention grants, small community grants around the country, just to make people aware and kind of do outreach and education to let everybody know about the issue and know that they can have an impact on solving it.
It isn't just trash. It isn't just plastic, rather, that you work with. I know that you've done collages, Aurora, of junk mail. What a great thing to do with junk mail. How do you see beauty? Because a lot of your stuff is just stunningly beautiful. How do you see beauty in trash and discarded pieces of plastic?
Oh, I don't. I find it really irritating. My job is to make it, not that. So I always sort of live by this idea of what you resist persists. Carl Jung said this, mm-hmm. and I try to apply that in my life. Or, you know, this idea of irritation creating mutation. So the things, like, that's my fodder, the things that bother me the most. When I see a lot of litter or get a lot of junk mail, even though I've unsubscribed and, you know, taken my name off lists and, you know, I don't know how they know when you have a baby, but suddenly you start getting all these catalogs and, you know. Right. So I always find that has a lot of potential.
But how do you see, I mean, this, for instance, this work that you have of stuff that floated up on the southern tip of Hawaii, the main island of Hawaii, all this ocean plastic that you recovered, I don't know how to describe it, but it's very colorful and it's very creative. And, I mean, I'm just curious as to how you take whatever the central piece is, which doesn't look unlike a coffee filter basket, but I'm sure that's not what it is, and decide, okay, well, I can design a whole thing around that, or I can add this piece to that and put this orange piece of plastic next to this yellow piece of plastic, and I'll have a satisfying work of art, which is what you end up with. How do you do that?
Well, I mean, I think my work is really all about taking something negative, which was these nightmares I had, and trying to subjugate the negative, transform it into something somehow inviting. Mm-hmm. And I do that both personally and in a larger way. So that's kind of a tricky, you know, thing. Like, how do you do that? That's a good question. The techniques I use are, I look at the formal and structural properties of things that are inarguably positive. Like light, for example. We all need that. We know that's essential. Water. Water is an incredible, like, it's the one thing that makes it so that, one of the few things that makes it so we can live on this planet. Mm-hmm. We haven't really found any others that have that quality, so maybe we should protect it. You know, stuff like that. And also how a heart forms, or how societies form, how people fall in love. What does that look like if you could draw a diagram of it? Mm. And I try to integrate all of those kinds of ideas into my formal decisions when I'm constructing a piece.
Despite Aurora's efforts to pull as much plastic out of the waste stream as she can and turn it into works of art, we still have tons of it out there. Is this a growing problem, Mike, or is it? Have we reached stasis on this because of the development of recycling programs? Have we slowed it down? Are we in a holding pattern? Where are we in terms of what we're putting out there?
I don't know if we have leveled off yet because humans are so inventive with new ways to use this material. The same way that artists are inspired by all the properties of it. You hear the same thing from people who are trying to figure out packaging or...
Well, when you think about it, who would have thought, 20 years ago, that we would be paying money for water?
Right.
As opposed to just going to the water fountain and drinking it. And then who would have thought that we'd have a gazillion plastic bottles being consumed because we buy this water every day?
Right. No, and and some of these things even sound great. You know, like I worked with a company once that, they've replaced the wooden pallet with a plastic pallet, and which makes it much sturdier, much more reusable, right. Much more cost effective. But we've just taken one of those steps that moves from materials that break down to materials that won't.
So the key question that Dan asks here through his email is, okay, now what? What should we do about this? Give us a couple of prescriptions to correct the problem. Who wants to throw one at us here?
Reusable bottle and a reusable bag when you go shopping. Okay. Two very simple things.
Yeah. I would just encourage people make sure that the infrastructure is there. So if you go to a restaurant and they don't have a plate, they're selling you bottled water, but they don't have a bin to collect the bottles, you need to make that known as a customer that they're not providing for your needs, and okay. You might go elsewhere.
Nancy?
I think those are both great suggestions. And, I mean, I just think if you can really evaluate what you're using on a daily basis and try to use less. And then, if you can participate in a cleanup in your local parks or local streams and rivers, or if you're near the coast on vacation, go out and participate in cleanup. See what's out there. It's pretty eye-opening when you start picking up the pieces of debris from a beach and see that it's your food wrappers and your plastic bottles and plastic bags. It makes you think a little differently when you're in your everyday life.
Suzanne Fetcher, thank you for finding Aurora, because this is the first time her work has been exhibited in the Southeast, and it opens today at the McCall Center for Visual Art and runs through the 26th of July. Also, Mike, you're screening a film on next Thursday evening at 6 called Bag It, Is Your Life Too Plastic? That's at the UN at the University of North Carolina Charlotte Uptown Campus. Aurora Robson, Dr. Mike Lizotte, Nancy Wallace from NOAA, and Suzanne Fetcher, thank you all for the hour.